Forward. When I see this pyramid-like piece of work, which differs from its brother monsters at the edge of the Libyan desert only in the fact that no hecatombs of scourged and panting slaves fell victim to its erection, but that it is the product of years of patient labor on the part of one man, when I see this formerly quadripartite work united as a proper entity between the two covers of a single volume, I am filled not only with justifiable astonishment at an almost incredible achievement in the art of bookmaking, but also with memories, with a kind of autobiographical pensiveness. Long years went into its making. To be exact, counting all interruptions, some of them quite protracted, a total of 16. A period of time, historically, as weighty with stories as the stubbornly independent product that grew up within it. Weighty in a sense that should have been detrimental to epic equanimity. Is it asking too much of posterity, assuming that we may look forward to any sort of intellectually active posterity? Is it asking too much to expect a bit of puzzled surprise that this narrative of 70,000 calmly flowing lines, telling of the primitive occurrences of human life, of love and hate, blessing and curse, fraternal strife and paternal grief, pride and penance, fall and rise, a humorous song of mankind, if one is allowed to call things by name, that this narrative could have come into being in the turbulent circumstances of these years 1926 to 1942, when every day hurled the wildest demands at the heart and the brain. As for me, I yield not to surprise, but to gratitude. I am grateful to this work, which was my staff and my stay on a path that often led through dark valleys. It was my refuge, my comfort, my home, my symbol of steadfastness, the guarantee of my perseverance in the tempestuous change of things. The Magic Mountain was completed in Munich in 1924 and was published the same year. Between its conclusion and the day when I found the courage to write the first sentence of The Descent into Hell, the overture to Joseph and his brothers, this, quote, "very deep is the well of the past," end of quote, there lies a period of no production, except the short story Disorder and Early Sorrow, improvised for the periodical Neue Rundschau on the occasion of my 50th birthday. It was one of those active relaxations which I enjoy with a certain degree of regularity after the discharge of a task that I have borne for years. Similarly, after Lotte in Weimar, The Transposed Heads, a metaphysical pleasantry, was created. And after the completion of the Joseph stories, the polemic against Nazism on behalf of human morality called The Tables of the Law. Slowly, after that day of the beginning, and after inditing the fantastic essay that serves as introduction and reminds one of the base of preparations for a hazardous exploratory expedition, the parts of the mythological novel grew, slowly and with anxious misgivings about all the time and space they demanded. They finally saw the light of day under the title The Tales of Jacob, simply because enough manuscript for substantial volume had accumulated, and not because the opus had been planned in several volumes as a series of novels or as a tetralogy. The whole thing, alas, had been planned differently, as always. Buddenbrooks had been envisioned as a story of mercantile life of perhaps 250 pages, and then grew beyond the bounds. The Magic Mountain, indeed, was to have been a short story of the size of Death in Venice, its grotesque sequel, so to speak. In the case of Joseph, I had had in mind a triptych of fairly long short stories of religious tinge, the first of which was to be of mythical, biblical character. The story of Joseph, to be retold in sprightly fashion, was chosen for this purpose. Habent sua fata libellae, not only after their publication, but particularly during their genesis. The author knows little about them when he lays hands on them. They have a mind of their own, and know what they are doing. The short stories of the Reformation and Counter-Reformation vanished, and for more than a decade and a half, I was to remain under the spell of the mythical, biblical ones. These, as long as the concept remained tenable, were intended as a unified, continuing story, as a single volume that had unfortunately become a little too portly, so that it might be said that only here and now, after years of disrupted existence, the story appears in its true form. Customarily, my narrative works are accompanied by essayistic offshoots, which may have been stimulated and requested by outside agencies, but which basically serve no other purpose than to strengthen me in the former. The treatises On the German Republic and Goethe and Tolstoy, to name only these, belong to the Magic Mountain. Those on Germany and the Germans, Dostoevsky and Nietzsche, to Dr. Faustus. It would be tedious to enumerate everything of the nature of such critical capers and marginalia pertaining to and colored by Joseph. They fill volumes, and constitute the greater part of the contents of the two English volumes entitled Order of the Day and Essays of Three Decades. As though the 60 pages of introduction to The Tales of Jacob had not sufficed to equip me and put me in the right frame of mind for the journey into the mythical land, it was followed in the same year, 1926, by the amorous analysis of Kleist's Amphitryon. Moreover, even the casual reader will find that the mythicizing introductory sentences of my lecture on Lessing prove that it too belongs in this orbit, or let us rather say that it has been brought into the orbit by gentle pressure. And I even interrupted myself with an autonomous narrative when I had just begun to narrate, in Mario and the Magician, a story with strong political inclinations, dealing with the psychology of fascism and of freedom, with the lack of will of the latter, which puts it at a great disadvantage with respect to the robust will of its opponent. It must be remembered that at the time when I began Joseph, the internal political post-war tensions in Germany had already become acute and had a constant disturbing effect on my daily life and thought. My conscience had been awake in a political sense since the outbreak of the First World War, which I had been constrained to recognize as the spectacular finale of the bourgeois era and the starting point of incalculable subversions. It availed me little to entitle the literary product of this consciousness of a turning point in the times, and at the time of a profound crisis in my own life, Betrachtungen eines Unpolitischen. After that, I was ensnared head and heart in politics, the very thing I had sought to ward off in this comprehensive book. From then on, I was compelled to take a definite stand. This book, a painful polemic, parts of which make a scandalous impression today, and from which quotations are used for my exposure in post-Hitler Germany and elsewhere, was a boundless, time-consuming piece of writing of rigorous self-examination and introspection, whose motto, "Compare yourself, recognize what you are," should have been supplemented by another. No one remains quite what he was when he recognizes himself. I helped my own development with this work, and after its completion, I was prepared to complement my literary Europeanism, of which the book is full, with political Europeanism, to accept the European democratic religion of humanity within my moral horizon, which so far had been bounded solely by late German Romanticism, by Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, Wagner. In a recent retrospective review, a clever Swiss critic called the Betrachtungen an, quote, essayistic adventure and cultural novel, a book of vanquishment and self-immolation for the sake of the secret demands of growth, end of quote. And he added that the cathartic function that it served in my life should also have operated on my German readers. This is the tragedy. Someone had taken pains on behalf of Christendom, as Claudel says, and Christendom had been too lazy to raise a finger. When I wrote the last word of the Betrachtungen, at the very latest, I no longer stood where I had when I wrote the first. But the Germans still stood there. They had complacently accepted my culturally conservative polemic, and they had regarded it as static rather than dynamic. In other words, they had misunderstood it. Whatever I did from then on, My defense of that poor creature of defeat, the universally sabotaged republic, my opposition to rising nationalism and to all the philosophic endeavors and maneuvers that promoted it, to vitalistic irrationalism, my appeal to reason, my intercession for Europe and for peace, all these were received at best with a dubious shrug, perhaps accompanied by the puzzled question, why does he do these things? Is he angling for a cabinet office? For the most part, however, my attitude was interpreted as treason and apostasy from a Germany that I saw reeling toward a barbaric people's dictatorship, toward war, toward destruction, taking Europe into the abyss with it. And from this Germany I had salvaged my soul at the 11th hour. Thanks to my political activities, I had to do my creative work in those 1920s under the pressure, under the spiritual disturbances and annoyances of national odium, and the official esteem in which the Republic held me made no difference. It only imposed on me the obligation of making all sorts of academic addresses at festive occasions. The unofficial, politically adjuring statements, articles, speeches went their own way. The tales of Jacob were finished, and a part of the young Joseph had been written when I made my tour of the Middle East to Egypt and Palestine early in 1930. It could hardly be called a trip for the purpose of study. It rather served for verifying on the spot the things of this sphere with which I had been concerned at a distance. At any rate, with my physical eyes, I saw the Nile country from the Delta up or down to Nubia and the memorable places of the Holy Land, and my impressions were of benefit to the third volume called Joseph in Egypt, part of which was still written in Germany. The essay Sufferings and Greatness of Richard Wagner belongs with this volume. 50 years had passed since the great music dramatist closed his eyes in Venice, and several cities in various countries had invited me to deliver lectures on his art. I wrote much more than I could hope to deliver orally, and in the abridged form in which I had cast my critical eulogy, I read it for the first time on February 10, 1933, before a thoroughly sympathetic audience at the University of Munich. On the following day, I set out with a minimum of baggage for Amsterdam, Brussels, and Paris, on the trip from which I was never to return to Germany. When I left Munich, Hitler was already Chancellor, but it was not until we were vacationing in the Swiss Alps that the major calamities took place, the burning of the Reichstag, the catastrophic victory of the Nazi Party in the election, the establishing of the dictatorship, and the National Revolution. At the same time, a murderous radio and newspaper campaign waged against me for my description of Wagner made my return home impossible. It meant an interruption of many months in my work on Joseph. A courageous child who had ventured to return to our confiscated house in Munich brought me the manuscript from there to southern France. Here, in loosely provisional circumstances, I was able to resume work on an undertaking that alone vouchsafed the continuity of my life. Joseph in Egypt was finished at long last, and in spite of many lengthy interruptions, at Küssnacht, on the Lake of Zurich, where we had moved in the autumn of 1933, and it was published in 1936 in Vienna, where the Berlin publishing house with which I was connected had found temporary refuge. This was the time of my ejection from membership in the German state, and the revocation of my honorary doctor's degree, now restored. To which I replied to the dean of the philosophical faculty of the University of Bonn in a letter that was translated into many languages. It was, moreover, the time of the founding of the Zurich periodical for free German culture, Maß und Wert, of which I was the responsible editor, and in which considerable portions of Lotte in Weimar appeared, the novel about Goethe, on which I had resumed work and which I again regarded as only a brief interlude. I was a member at that time of the Permanent Committee on Letters and Arts, appointed by the League of Nations, and before the establishment of the Third Reich I had participated in the meetings of this body in Geneva and in Frankfurt am Main. To a discussion in Nice, which I did not attend in person, I contributed a written memorandum of a political nature that created considerable sensation when it was read, and that was later included under the title Europe Beware in a collection of essays of the same name, Achtung Europa. I took part again in the meetings of the committee in Venice and Budapest. And it was at an open session in the Hungarian capital that I undertook to make an extemporaneous speech against the assassins of freedom and on behalf of the need of a militant democracy. It was a statement that offended, almost to the point of bad taste, against the rather academic character of the discussions, which were kept on a non-committal level, if only out of consideration for the fascist delegates. But it was received with a demonstration of approval lasting for many minutes on the part of the Hungarian public, and it earned me an enthusiastic embrace from Karel Čapek, the Czech dramatist, who died of a broken heart when the democracies betrayed his country. As early as 1934, I had made contact with America. The travel diary, Voyage with Don Quixote, was the literary product of my first Atlantic crossing. From then on, I crossed the ocean every year, and the preponderance of my existence began to shift to the other shore. For America, I wrote On the Coming Victory of Democracy, a lecture with which I made a tour of 14 cities in the United States in the winter of 1938. And for an American abridged edition of Schopenhauer, I wrote an introduction on this philosopher who had made such a deep impression on me in my youth. It is now included in the collection Essays of Three Decades. Other products of the years of my rotation between Europe and the New World include the two articles on Freud, the second of which served as an anniversary address in Vienna on the occasion of the 80th birthday of the great scholar, also the second lecture on Wagner, Richard Wagner and the Ring, given at the University of Zurich in connection with the gala production of the four operas. All these were interpolations in my work on the novel about Goethe, which in turn was an interpolation in the main epic undertaking, The Stories of Joseph. This intercalation of labors, inevitable, it seems, in certain cases of productive economy, is no mean spiritual burden. A major work pauses for the sake of a smaller one, the demands of which were not foreseen and which consume years. Under the pressure of the demands of the day, this too is set aside, and the author devotes himself to digressive tasks, many of which occupy not weeks but months. It only remains that these in turn should be interrupted by smaller and still smaller improvisations, while at the same time the greater and yet greater concerns must never be lost sight of. And so it comes about that the author must forever carry the totality of his work, with all its major and minor ramifications, in his head and on his shoulders. Patience alone can help him. An equanimity that, if nature has not endowed him with it, must be wrested from a nervous temperament tending toward despair. Durability, steadfastness, longevity are everything, and all his hope is time. Give me time, eternal gods, so runs his prayer, and everything shall be finished. My establishment in Princeton, New Jersey, took place in 1938, amid the most fearful political conditions, at the moment of Munich, the capitulation of democracy to fascism, the sacrificing of the Czech state and of all political morality to peace in our time. In profound dejection, tinged with indignation, I wrote this piece, a bitter indictment of the policies of the Western powers, debased by their fear of Russian socialism. Lotte in Weimar was continued in new surroundings, in face of impediments incident to acclimatization. But my connection with the university as visiting professor also imposed mild duties on me. Public lectures and lectures to advanced students on Goethe's Faust and Werther, on Freud, on the history of the European novel, and even on the Magic Mountain had to be prepared. I spent the summer of 1939 in Europe, in England, Switzerland, and Holland. On the beach at Noordwijk, I wrote the introduction of Tolstoy's Anna Karenina at the request of Random House of New York. This, too, was incorporated in the German and English collection of my literary essays. Surprised in Sweden by the war, if the word surprise is appropriate, We had a somewhat distressing, perhaps even perilous, trip home, first by air to London, and then on the overcrowded SS Washington. I carried many papers, lecture notes, and books with me, which were the object of tedious inspection at the remote and camouflaged London airport. The inspecting officers were particularly suspicious of a sketch representing the seating arrangement at a dinner that Goethe gave in his house on the Frauenplan in Weimar in honor of the sweetheart of his youth. It was suspected of being of strategic importance, and I had to deliver a condensed lecture on the novel in order to convince the officials of the complete innocence of the paper. Lotte in Weimar was then nearing completion. In the same year, I finished the book in Princeton with the spectral dialogue between Goethe and Lotte in the carriage. Now, at last, after an interruption of about 5 years, I was free to go to work on the final volume of Joseph and His Brothers. I was filled with a powerful urge to complete this narrative that I had brought along from Germany and that had survived all vicissitudes. Mythical memories, playful parallels, not inappropriate to the topic, increased my inclination. I was standing where Wagner had stood when, after the interpolation of Tristan and Die Meistersinger, he resumed work on the dramatic epic, the gigantic fairy tale, The Ring of the Nibelung. It is true that my treatment of myth was fundamentally more closely related to the humor of Goethe's classical Walpurgis Night than to the pathos of Wagner, but the unexpected evolution that the story of Joseph had followed was nevertheless somehow secretly determined by the recollection of Wagner's grandiose structure. It had moved in its footsteps, working with themes invented long before, transforming and elaborating them, carrying them all to a crowning climax. I now had to add a cheerful Goethe Dämmerung to my three existing fairy tale operas. I looked forward to it, and yet I was reluctant to go to work. It was not because the clay had become dry in the many turbulent years. With tooth and nail I had clung to the old task amid all distractions, and it was alive within me. The reason for my reluctance was simply this, that I feared an anticlimax, a falling off of the fourth volume from the third. The latter, Joseph in Egypt, seemed to me unquestionably the artistic zenith of the work, if only on account of the humane vindication that I had undertaken in it, the humanization of the figure of Potiphar's wife, the mournful story of her passionate love of the Canaanite major domo, of her pro forma husband. I had no female character in stock to balance the Rachel of the first and second novels, the Moot M. Ennett of the third, and it took a long time before I became aware that I had one after all. It was Tamar, the daughter-in-law and seductress of Judah, whom I made into Jacob's pupil, an Astarte-like figure, endowed at the same time with features from the Book of Ruth. And in half-humorous style, I developed her into the prototype of historical ambition. Through her, who eventually gave her name to an entire section of the novel, a short story in itself, I found the fulfillment of the charms of the remaining material, and the final incentive to continue the narrative. Even today I see no exaggeration in the sentence of the text that reads, "She might be called the most amazing figure in this whole story. Few will be found to deny it." Nevertheless, I put still one other theme ahead of the resumption of the main task, the Indian legend of the Transposed Heads, completed in Princeton. Finally, in Brentwood, California, where I spent the spring and part of the summer of 1940, I found the long, silent, lyric tone of the biblical saga again, and the opening chapters of Joseph the Provider were written. The history of the genesis of this volume, the brightest and cheeriest in mood of them all, is no less agitated, perhaps even more so, than that of the three others, and still fuller of interruptions, to which I always yielded unwillingly and yet with all my heart. It developed amid the terrible tensions of a war upon whose outcome the fate of the world, of Western civilization, in fact of all that I held dear, seemed to depend. Of the war that at first showed such ill-boding aspects, into which, after the fall of France, the country of which I was about to become a citizen entered, just as Achilles left his tent after the death of Patroclus. the war into whose service I again and again felt impelled to place my heart and my head and my pen. The war and the world which it promised to create are the subjects of the impromptu essays that belong chronologically to the fourth volume of Joseph. Things like This War, The Problem of Freedom, and others. And I used them as lectures with which I fulfilled my obligations as Fellow of the Library of Congress in Washington. But even in Princeton, before migrating to California after the expiration of my visiting professorship, I had begun to write regular monthly radio messages to Germany at the behest of the British Broadcasting Corporation, the total number of which was to reach 55 in the course of the war years. 28 days of each month were devoted to Joseph, 4 weeks of liberty and of mythical playfulness. Then came a day or two when I was no longer the creative writer, but a summoner to battle with all my heart. Days when I gave free rein to my hatred of the despoilers of Germany and of Europe, to transfer it later to the spinning disk in a state of agitation that art can never engender, but only life and its primal emotions. And then back again to the work of peace and the temple theater, the humorously exact realization of the unreal by staging and discussion. The California sky, so like the Egyptian, smiled on my work. To it, the story undoubtedly owes much of its cheerfulness, for while there were many alarmists who fled the West Coast in fear of Japanese attacks, I, on the contrary, utilizing the last moment when building was still possible, had erected my house in the Santa Monica Hills. Joseph the Provider is that part of the work that was written in America from the first word to the last, and there can be no doubt that it received its share of the spirit of the country. That spirit is reflected not only in the success story, which it is by nature and by design, not only in the occasional, gladly accepted Anglo-Saxon coloration of its German diction. The spirit of the tale, if anyone is interested in my mythical opinion, is a spirit untrammeled to the point of abstraction, whose medium is speech in and of itself, speech in the abstract, which regards itself as absolute and pays little attention to idiom and to local linguistic divinities. I have no objection if, for example, the critics say that the German of the prelude in the upper circles in Joseph the Provider is really not German anymore. Suffice it that it is speech, and suffice it that the entire opus is fundamentally a work of speech, in whose polyphony sounds of the primitive Orient mingle with the most modern, with the accents of fictive scientific method, and that it takes pleasure in changing its linguistic masks as often as its hero changes his god masks, the last of which looks remarkably American. For it is the mask of an American Hermes, a brilliant messenger of shrewdness, whose New Deal is unmistakably reflected in Joseph's magic administration of national economy. The year 1942 was drawing to a close when I finished. Under the last line of the Magic Mountain, 18 years earlier, I had, with some solemnity, written Finis Operis. What a pleasantly self-willed, utterly discriminating force is individual style. This time, it prompted me to disguise the finis in the manner of patriarchal storytellers, so that the title of the whole work, Joseph and His Brothers, appears prominently as the final word of the last sentence. Here, then, is the whole work in a single binding, in Helen Low Porter's admirable translation, an achievement of loyalty and devotion which this woman would not have been able to accomplish without faith in the worthiness of her task. May I share this faith? How will posterity regard this work? Will it soon become a dust-covered curio for antiquarians, the easy prey of fleeting time? Or will its pleasantries cheer those who come after us, its pathos touch them? Or will it perhaps be numbered among the great books? I do not know, and no one can tell me. But as the son of a tradesman, I have a fundamental faith in quality. What is it that has helped many a product of human hands through the ages, given it strength to resist the centuries, and restrained mankind in its wildest days from destroying it? only one thing, quality. The Song of Joseph is good, solid work, done out of that fellow feeling for which mankind has always been sensitively receptive. A measure of durability is, I think, inherent in it. Thomas Mann, Pacific Palisades, California, February 1948.